And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
When we think about our national parks, we most often think of amazing places, the grand landscapes of the Tetons, historic buildings like the Truman Home, and monuments like the National Mall. But there's another side to our national parks that we only see a glimpse of. Today, we probe inside one of the nation's most amazing museum collections as we talk with the new curator of the national parks when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
June 2008. A very interesting time in history. Woke up this morning, spent time listening to the news last night, and with all the talk of the oil prices reaching record levels and possibly going from $140 to $150, and now they're saying $250 a barrel, and talking about as well the price of a gallon of gas going from our current $4, I'm paying $4.50 a gallon here in San Diego, but going up to $6, I don't understand how we're supposed to deal with this. And then as well, the markets around the world are swirling in response to this, and it creates a terrific amount of instability in terms of how we sort of foresee our future. And the way out of this is also a bit confusing. At least it is for me. I don't see a clear path ahead. I don't think anybody has that figured out yet. And so with that in mind, this is the fact that we're kind of heading off into uncharted territory. This is makes me think of some of the early pioneers who would head out west into the wildlands without really knowing what they were getting into, only mere stories or, and perhaps in some cases, no information at all. And yet they did, and somehow most of them probably did all right, but with a huge learning curve. And I think that's, to a large degree, what we're headed for here. Certainly the answer is that in the future, we're going to have to look at how we've been living on this planet to this day, up to the 21st century, and realize that as the world moves into the future, we're going to have to make some changes, particularly in our sense of consumption habits and what we think is the good life, because the good life is suddenly at risk for many people and for those without, who have never had the opportunity to even experience the good life. For them, it's hard for me to understand how they're going to cope. Well, with that in mind, it makes me think that our legacy, what has brought us to this point in our history, is such an important thing for us to keep in mind, to familiarize ourselves with. And it reminds me, growing up, as I was a kid, I was very fortunate to have some ancient old grandparents living in a farm in Wisconsin. And for about a week every year, we'd go out there. That was a highlight of my life. But one of the great moments was during that week, I'd find some quiet time in the middle of the summer where things were kind of slowed down and life was easy. And I'd wander up into the attic, and there I'd find boxes and wooden chests and things. And I would probe through them. I'd sneak and take peeks and find old photographs, clothing, objects from the historic past. Or I'd head out to the barn and start poking my nose into all of these corners and drawers and things and find tools the likes of which I'd never seen before. That is our legacy, and it's priceless. And the opportunity to experience that, the smells, the colors, the feels and textures of our antiquity, is an extraordinarily valuable thing. And I kind of wonder about kids today as they go through our remnants, if they're going to basically end up with old CDs and iPods and other such things. Hopefully, we'll be able to leave them as well with some extraordinarily valuable human remembrances. So that's why today I'm really excited about the fact that we're going to be talking to a man who has the most amazing job. He's the new curator of the National Park Collections, the museums, these extraordinary collections that have captured and are the repository of so much history. We oftentimes think of our national parks and love them for their beauty and their wonder, and they capture so many things, the ancient houses and historic places. But behind all of that is a kind of a hidden story of all of the things that come with that. And there are those within the national parks whose job it is to catalog that and care for them, preserve them. And so today, a fascinating look at the grand wonders of the national park collections. All of my life, I've been fascinated by just about everything. It's a blessing and a curse. I'm fascinated by nature and animals and behavior, but as well cultural things, ancient antiquities and art forms and architecture. And therefore, I have found through time that museums have served me very well because they allow me to go in and look and learn and see. And I'm a museum person. I was fortunate to grow up outside of Chicago and have access to some of the best museums in the world, the Field Museum in Chicago. And so it's been a lifelong pursuit. That's why I'm so excited about talking to our guest today, Ronald Wilson, who is the new chief curator of the National Park Service and the head of the Park Museum Management Program. Ron, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Glad to be here.
Ron, I think you're a very lucky guy. You have the ultimate, most amazing job in the world, as far as I'm concerned, because you're overseeing one of the most extraordinary collections, when you talk about the National Park Service, in the world.
Well, the Park Service collections are among the largest collections within the federal sector, about the only agency that has more items in their collection than the Park Service is the Smithsonian. So the Smithsonian is sometimes referred to as the nation's attic, and I guess I think of the Park Service collections as sometimes as sort of the front parlor, or because the collections that we present in the national parks really do interpret the full story of American history, the natural history of the continent, and all related things. So our total collection is somewhere around 120 million things that are available for use and to tell the stories of the parks. And of those, they range the gamut from prehistoric items, paleontological items, history items, the story of the earth, archival materials, biological materials, and so forth. So it is a very broad, very diverse body of objects, and one of the most important things about this collection is it's the real stuff. It's not just something that was designed as an image in someone's mind. It is the material that is directly related to the resources that are the reason the parks exist.
This would also include the buildings as well?
No. The museum program focuses only on the movable objects. There's another program within the National Park Service that focuses on the historic buildings, actually several other programs. So the focus is on the objects themselves, the artifacts, the natural science specimens, and all related stuff, but no real property items, including buildings.
120 million objects is a lot. The diversity and as well the historic value of this to our nation and its people and the world is unmeasurable. I'm just curious how in the world, as you look at that diversity of objects and things, how you begin to sort of categorize them, because that's what curators do. They have to figure out how, okay, you get something in your hand, you look at it, and you say, okay, where does this belong in our catalog? How do you go about categorizing this enormous collection of different objects?
Well, no matter what you're talking about, you can always subdivide it into more and more specific categories. The first split is between cultural collections and natural collections. So for the natural resource collections, that includes things like biology, which is further broken down into zoology and botany, paleontology, geologic specimens, things like that. And then on the cultural side, we have art, history, archaeology, ethnography, and archives. Actually, the archives bridge both the cultural and the natural collections because they are the associated documentation that preserves the meaning of the objects themselves.
Right. I know that Yellowstone has a tremendous collection of paintings.
Yeah.
By some of the early painters, as well. There's many writings, journals, and other things. Are there some favorite things that you've run across in your time that you think are really kind of almost surprised you or really thrilled you?
The collections really parallel the diversity of the parks themselves. So while some parks were created to preserve a historic site, a historic battlefield, others were created to preserve the great landscape, the wilderness. So the objects that are in the collections are directly related to the stories that are told in the parks. Because of that, there are things like 4,000-year-old woven slippers that were left behind by the people that were exploring Mammoth Cave 4,000 years ago, and they were preserved because of the constant environment in the cave and the very stable conditions that allowed them to survive for all that time. There are things in the paleontological realm, like Dinosaur National Monument, for example, a really exceptional site for dinosaurs that died and were preserved in a sandbar in a river millions of years ago. Dozens of skeletons of dinosaurs preserved there. At Dinosaur, you can actually see them in exactly the condition where they were found, and the scientists have been working for years on exposing the bones, and while leaving many of them exposed in the bedrock, so you can see exactly how that happened. In the military area, there are things that tell the story of Civil War prisoners at Andersonville. There are things that tell the story of the Revolutionary War with George Washington's tent at Morristown, for example. It's really hard to pick a favorite thing because there are so many wonderful things in all of these different subject areas.
It's such an amazing diversity of things. I saw reference to you as a strong generalist, and I can really relate to that. There's so much information, you can't become a specialist in more than a few of them, let's put it that way.
Academically, my background is in biology, mm-hmm. but in the part of biology that intersects with geology in the paleontology area and intersects with anthropology in the archaeology area. So I was focusing early in my career on identifying animal bones that were found in archaeological sites.
Hmm.
I work with Ice Age mammals that were found in caves throughout the Southeast, things like that. And then once I got into the museum field, all the collections I've worked with have been very broad general collections, ranging from costumes to minerals. So you really do learn to appreciate the importance of each of these subdisciplines, even if you don't have any specific expertise in a particular area. You can see that it's important to telling a story, either in the science area or in the story of human history or prehistory.
You have such a wealth of, what's the best way to refer to this, I want to say stuff, things, artifacts? What's the way that you generally refer to them so that I could make this easier on myself?
Well, there's a range of possibilities.
Okay.
Anything made by people is an artifact.
Okay.
Anything that occurs in nature is usually referred to as a specimen.
Okay.
But beyond that, object is a very generic term, but used more frequently to refer to cultural items. And then just the word item itself is about as generic as you can get. So item and stuff are sort of synonymous in this context, I think.
Gotcha.
I mentioned that each of the parks collections is directly related to the resources in those parks. In terms of acquiring the collection, we don't want to be just a random pile of stuff, of things that anybody might walk in with. So each of the parks has a very well-considered document, which we call the scope of collection, that defines very clearly the categories of things that that particular park is going to collect, and the categories of things that the park is not going to collect, because especially in the numbers that we're dealing with, managing museum collections is very labor-intensive, it's very expensive, and we don't want to waste our limited resources on objects that we really aren't going to be using to tell the story of the park. So that scope of collection statement becomes very important in serving as sort of the gatekeeper of what comes into the collection and what stays out.
Now, would you find a curator in most parks, all parks? How does that work?
It varies a lot from full-fledged museums in some parks and other parks that only have a few items that may be in an exhibit case in the visitor center. So many of the park collection management activities are actually done by what we call collateral duty curators, where it's not their primary responsibility, but it may be someone in the natural resource area or the cultural resource area or the interpretation area, where they have some interest in the collection and take care of the basic day-to-day management activities, the reporting activities, things like that. But many of our collections are also managed in four centers that we have around the country, where there are literally many millions of things in one place. And there, of course, we have several full-time curators. And some of the parks that have the larger and most active collections also have full-time curators. So within the Park Service as a whole, there are probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 600 people that have some museum management responsibility, but a much smaller subset of that actually have curatorial training as their primary area of expertise.
I love interpretive centers and museums in parks. It's one of the great ways to where the story is told. And I'm just curious how it is that the interpretive story interacts with the collections and curators to kind of help, because there has to be a collaboration.
You're definitely right about the collaboration part. And whenever an interpretive plan is being developed for a particular park, the interpreters have to look at the story they want to tell and then look around for, well, what's available to help us tell this story. And usually it's a combination of actual landscapes or buildings in the park, information about the people that were involved there, archival documents that describe the significance of the park resources. And then if we're really lucky, there are things that are original to the site, historic artifacts that were used by the family that lived there or artifacts that were recovered through archaeology about the people that lived at this location or were somehow involved in creating the significance that made it a national park in the first place. So the role of the curator or collection manager is to have documented the collection, cataloged it, so that the interpreters can then look at the catalog record and find out what's there. And they use the associated information to determine its significance and whether or not it's going to be useful to them to tell the particular story that they want to tell. Of course, the particular story may change over time in some cases. So for any large museum collection, a relatively small percentage is on exhibit at any one time, but the rest is there to support research activity, to tell the new twist of the story that the interpreters come up with. And it's very much a collaboration where the interpreters come up with the story they want to tell, and then the curatorial program shares information that we have collected and preserved about the objects in our collection that may be useful to the interpreters and telling that story.
Now, I have to believe every once in a while, in the process of creating an interpretive center, someone comes across a piece, they say, oh my gosh, that's the piece we need. But it, unfortunately, is so fragile or so valuable that you really can't necessarily bring it out there. How do you face those kinds of challenges?
Well, it's always a balancing act of balancing, and the same balancing act exists with the parks as a whole, where you know, the Organic Act that created the National Park Service says we are to preserve the resources of the park for the enjoyment of the public. So sometimes the preservation versus enjoyment missions conflict, and there's a constant balancing involved. One of the kinds of collections that is often very fragile is archival material, original letters from the 17th century or the 18th century. So the conservation standards that apply there are to limit the light exposure so that the inks don't fade, the papers don't deteriorate, and so forth. And yet, if you need to get it out in front of the public, it needs to be in front of the public in the light where it's going to tell the story. So one of the techniques that's often used there, if it's a rare archival item that cannot withstand a long exposure to light, is to make a photographic facsimile that conveys the flavor of the original and gives a good sense of what the original looks like, but the original stays tucked away in the dark, where it'll be available for the next few hundred years, while the public still gets to see the important aspects of it.
I have to believe part of your role is a process of looking at new discoveries and kind of cataloging them, cleaning them up, and preserving them.
Well, this is an area where the curatorial staff collaborates very closely with the resource management staff. So many of our collections originate as a result of managing the resources within the park. So whenever an archaeological site is impacted by any other activity in the park, the Archaeological Resources Protection Act kicks in, and there has to be a archaeological survey and a mitigation of the site that would be otherwise damaged or lost by that activity. Also, in understanding the cultural history at a particular park, it's important to do archaeological research so that you get the full story that's available within the archaeological resources that are there. Similarly, if you're trying to understand the ecosystem that exists within a park, having the biological specimen from that place over a period of time helps to tell the story. So the curatorial staff are very involved in planning projects, either in cultural resource management or natural resource management. They are involved in the permitting process, so when people apply to do a research project in the park, they request a permit. The permit has to identify any collections that are coming into the collection as a result of that research. The proper repository has to be identified there, and the funding has to be identified for the initial preparation of those items as they enter the collection. Because once the project's over, they're going to be there in perpetuity, meaning just about forever. It's important to fund the curation or the care of those collections right up front so that you don't add to a backlog of uncatalogued things.
I know that the responsibility of caring for these things, particularly from the perspective of curation and preservation, is a very fine art. But obviously, as well, there's a lot that the public would like to see. And I'm just curious how you're making it possible for people to really experience the collections. Are there some places where the collections are at least partly or wholly open to the public? What other forms, including online, are you working on these days?
As I mentioned, a very small percentage of the collection is in active use at any particular time. And the exhibits that exist in visitor centers and in Park Service museums are usually selected because they are the most complete, the most photogenic, the most significant objects that are in the collection. And many of the things that are maintained because of their scientific value are things like potsherds or flint chips, that where we have many thousands and thousands of those, but you don't have to show everyone to the public to get the idea across that there were some broken pots found at the site. Again, it's all related to storytelling. You know, so whether it's a physical exhibit in a visitor center, you're telling a particular story, a particular perspective on the resources of the park. But we also do that online. And at the Park Museum Management Program website, we have a couple dozen virtual exhibits that tell particular stories in the areas related to the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, paleontology, American presidents, the American West, archaeological sites, cowboys, the Everglades, Alcatraz Island, and particular tribal stories of related to the Nez Perce tribe or Chaco Canyon in New Mexico or the Navajo people. There, again, we are providing high-quality images of some of the best items from the collections that tell those particular stories.
I've visited the site, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's at www.nps.gov/history/museums?
That's correct.
Yes.
And once you get to that point, there's a navigation bar at the top of the page that allows you to look at the online exhibit to get some sense of the scope of a particular park collection profile, teaching materials, lesson plans for teaching with National Park Service Museum collection. There's also an exhibit called Treasures of the Nation that just highlights some of the things that are truly of national significance that just let people know what's in the collection.
This is a beautiful tool. So who's ever put this together has done a really nice job. It's opening up so much information that otherwise, as you say, may not be available generally through interpretive centers or other means, but really done in a way that is very exciting, and it's an adventure to explore the various parameters and the images and different things. So I encourage everybody to visit that, particularly now as we're hearing, and it's a sad story. I don't exactly know what this means, and you don't have to respond to this, but this is my personal thing, that I'm concerned about the fact that with the price of gas becoming so oppressive that a lot of people are just not going to be able to hop in their car, as they always have been able to in the past, and just drive to a wonderful national park, and it's a bit sad. However, that being said, the opportunity for us to visit these parks through the internet is very powerful, very useful.
Yeah, many of the parks have very diverse information on their park-specific websites. They include the management plans of the park, the interpretive themes of the park, a description of the museum collections that are associated with the park, as well as information on how to plan a visit and why the park exists and what's to see there once you do get there. But you're right, the travel costs are certainly increasing, and that affects our management activities, our meetings activities as well.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than always offering only training for our staff, we are developing some online training tools. We are also developing more and more interactive virtual exhibits that make things more and more accessible to the public.
One of the things that I came across in exploring the site, I'm going to repeat this again, at www.nps.gov/history/museum, was the Field Manual for Museums, which is it's a historic tome for within the National Park Service, and that particular 460-some page document is now available online.
Most of our guidance documents are available online. The field manual that you referred to is an earlier version of our museum handbook, and then the three-volume or three-part museum handbook is our current guidance, with part one dealing with preservation and protection issues, basic collections, how to develop a scope of collection statement. Part two deals with the cataloging process, how things come into the collection, and then how to process them so that they are available. And then part three focuses on use of collection and some of the legal issues associated with copyright and shared ownership issues that impact the use of collection.
I myself believe that there's two types of people in the world. One, people who collect things, and then those people who don't. It's oftentimes very definable. And there's a lot of people who love to collect things. Children come in naturally wanting to pick things up and sort them out and find, you know, connections and how they're different. It's just a natural thing for many, many people. And so the opportunity, if that's your nature, to be able to go and see how this is done professionally within the National Park Service is now so available through your site.
One of the resources that we have on the website is under the tab called Teaching with Collections, and one of the options there is How to Read an Object, where it really tells a child or anybody else who's curious about it of, well, how do you evaluate an object? What is its function? What's it called? What was it used for? What its physical characteristics? What was it made of? Who made it? Why was it made? How was it made? What are the design elements? What's the context? When, where, who, how? All those sorts of questions. And then what kinds of values does a particular object have? So this chart, which is available on the website on how to read an object, just goes through a whole list of questions that help you think about the significance of a particular object. And this is exactly the same list of questions that we go through when we catalog an object. We want to be sure we capture the significance of the object by, and we want to be sure that we're accurately understanding the object, so that we don't make up stuff about it, but we ask a lot of questions to be sure that we record what's important about it, and then that importance will be obvious to future users of the collection.
That particular tool should be made available to virtually every school in the world. It is available. That's the interesting thing.
Yeah.
That's what's so cool about it. You know, it is available. And, I encourage every teacher, every parent, anyone who knows kids, whatever else, or even themselves to go there, because that is how we need to look at our world these days. Science is important. Understanding how the world works, asking the right questions, trying to figure out how it all fits together is critical now, more so than ever before, to making the right decisions into the future. And we have to learn how to really think and look at our world. And that's great. I so much appreciate that. And I'll put a link directly to that document on the show page. That's exciting. Now, we're talking with Ron Wilson, who's the new chief curator of the National Park Service. As you look out at this vast, extraordinary resource of wonder, give us a couple of examples where you feel you're really proud, you're excited about what's happening in the system.
I'm proud to have be coming into this position after a century of predecessors who have done a pretty terrific job in building the program, developing the resource materials, the publications, the management tools that guide the program. So while it's very satisfying personally to be taking the helm of this vast collection, it's also very humbling to know all the great folks who have come before and develop the tools that I will be using. But the collection do get a lot of use. We have about 200,000 requests a year for research-related things. We have over 10 or 11 million objects on loan for use in exhibits and research projects by other institutions. So as I come into this, I'm really trying to get a deeper understanding of what is already available, but then looking to the future, how can we make things more accessible to get to more people, and how do we tell some of the stories that are otherwise just hidden in the catalog? For example, at the beginning of this discussion, you mentioned some of the art collections at Yellowstone. Some of the Yellowstone collection includes a couple dozen original Thomas Moran watercolors. Thomas Moran was the artist who first painted the canyon of the Yellowstone and brought the painting back, showed it to Congress, and inspired Congress to create Yellowstone as a national park back in the 1870s. One of the stories that's associated with that particular collection of Thomas Moran watercolors is that they were purchased with the assistance of John D. Rockefeller, Jr. And there's correspondence in the park files about the director of the Park Service had requested assistance in acquiring these pieces of art. And Mr. Rockefeller wrote a letter saying, well, personally, they wouldn't interest me greatly, certainly not at anything approaching the price that you're talking about, but I'm glad to join you and with others, since you gentlemen think it is desirable for the park to have these pictures. So he provided $1,000 to help buy those collections, but didn't want to go the full $4,000 price that
$4,000,
that existed back in the 1920s for these things. So that, you know, that gives a little insight into the importance of public patronage in building some of these collections.
You couldn't touch any one of those Morans probably for less. I didn't even know what the value of a single original Moran watercolor is, probably $100,000 a piece. So it was a good investment.
I don't really give a lot of thought to the actual dollar value of these things because our focus is on the other values that are associated with the items. How does it help tell the story? What is its value to managing the resource? How can we best use these things? Another example would be some of the Alaskan Chilkat weavings and baskets. That are in the collections at Sitka National Historic Site, where tribal members come to the park collection and study the weaving patterns, study the construction of some of the baskets and so forth, so that their contemporary work is true to the history of the items that were created by their ancestors.
Yeah, that's the real beauty of the way this all fits together. The ancient history and as well our life now and life into the future, and all the more reason that these things have to be preserved. To what degree do you collaborate with the public who may have collections or items? How do you interact that way?
Well, there's several possibilities there. Certainly, many of our collections are generated by the resource management activities that occur within the parks, but many of our parks also have a long history of, and there may be many items, historic objects or ethnographic objects that were associated with that place before it became a park. And many of the collections that fit that category end up being donated by the people that were associated with that earlier activity in their own families, and many of the people are willing to donate things because they see the significance of the connection. But sometimes those things are not available except through purchase. And in some cases, several of the parks have cooperating associations that help raise funds that can be used to purchase really significant things that come up. But here again, the scope of collection statement that I mentioned earlier becomes really significant, so that we know that we're only considering adding things to the collection that really tell the story and really do help the collection as a whole, so that we don't expend resources on things that just duplicate things that are already in the collection.
Virtually almost every historic site has been plundered in one way or another, and particularly with pot shards. And the unfortunate thing, and this is part of the story, is that although a person may have inherited, let's say, a collection of who knows how many hundreds or thousands of pot shards and arrow points or whatever else that have been picked up, the fact that we don't know where exactly they came from really diminishes their, unfortunately, diminishes their scientific value. That's
right.
The type of thing where you really have to make a decision.
Right, and usually our archaeological materials are only collections that are the result of systematic research, systematic archaeological work within the park. Because if we don't know where it came from, and it's not particularly unique, then it really has diminished value as an interpretive item or as a research item. So things like that do occasionally appear of well-meaning visitors picking up something while they're wandering around the park, and they bring it to the park's visitor center. And some of those can be used in informal interpretive activities, hands-on things that can be destroyed because the long-term value of them has often been destroyed by the lack of information that comes with them.
Again, to reinforce the concept that if you find something in a park, don't pick it up. Inform people associated with the curatorial efforts and let them learn scientifically where it is and its significance.
Right, because you can definitely do more damage than good if you move things around that need to stay where they are.
Well, Ronald Wilson, new chief curator of the National Park Service, you've got a fascinating job.
And, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, you're a lucky guy. It's been great talking with you. We encourage all people to get out to the national parks and enjoy this extraordinary collection of wonder that is priceless. We're extremely fortunate as Americans that we have had the foresight to create this system that now serves us so well. Ron Wilson, thank you so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming along on this week's Wild Side News. We're going to continue telling you the stories that make the news about nature and the environment in the months and years ahead. Expanding, growing, ever-changing. I invite you all to come along. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet next Tuesday or any time on the archives when your voice of the earth rings out around the world here on the Wild Side News.